This week, we dive into Ancient and Modern Initiation by Max Heindel with Part 2, Chapter 2, The Mystic Rite of Baptism. What's so mystic about baptism? Is baptism even important? And is there such a thing as a cosmic baptism? Then, we're going to dive into the world of ancient knowledge and how it's transmitted. From the Emerald Tablets of Thoth to the Pillars of Enoch, to the pillars said to have been constructed by the sons and daughters of Lamech, to the Masonic pillars. What's the truth about how all of this is conveyed throughout time? All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 486. Right off the top, as usual, I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and our legacy partners for continuing to assist us in helping to bring this show to you for almost 10 years. Not a lot of podcasts make it 10 years. I mean, there are some big ones out there, but for a niche podcast like this one, a subject like Freemasonry, well, not many out there. Now, I know you might be thinking, hey, what the heck? I just heard the show opener and there's no excerpt from the interview with John Ruark on the Master's Word. That's right. We had to push off 1 week because I was ill-prepared to accomplish the interview. And then last week, John had some schedule conflicts. We were not able to complete that interview. However, I can tell you that the interview will be coming. We have a time scheduled again. And actually, it'll be the first time we're going to do it via video. So whether we go live or not, I don't know, but I will tell you that we will post the video of the interview as the episode, and then we'll just rip the audio and send that straight through for our podcast also. So there'll be the best of both worlds there. The next thing on the agenda, I want to mention everybody who's been picking up The Master's Word, A Short Treatise on the Word, the Light, and the Self. You know, I do have that in the shop on the WCY podcast website, and we did run into a little bit of a back order situation. I underestimated the number of people who would be buying this book, so I have ordered lots more, and I am sending them out as soon as I get them in. So like today I got 10 more copies, and I had to wrap those all up and get them out to you. So when you order through the website, of course, you get an email from PayPal the second I print postage, which means it's going out that day. If you get those emails, then it's on the way. And rest assured, if you haven't got it yet, it is coming, I promise. Couple updates. If you are somebody who subscribes to the Fraternal Review, I thank you, number one. And number two, you probably are holding in your hands now an issue of the Fraternal Review that is all about the Masonic Legacy Society. I hope you find that particular issue of interest and you are inspired. For more information on another project we've got going on, the Wilmshurst University Project, I ask you to check out wilmshurstuniversity.com for more information. Get on the email list to be notified as soon as classes are posted. And this last update, nothing too crazy except for, maybe there's a new podcast coming. We'll see how it goes. Brother Darren Laners and I have decided to have a little chit-chat about something that's not even Masonic. It's just an interest, a mutual interest, and maybe many of you will have an interest in it as well. What is it? Well, more on that in the future, but be ready for when that drops. Now let's get started with the first thing for this week, and that is Ancient and Modern Initiation by Max Heindel, Part 2, Chapter 2. The Mystic Rite of Baptism. It is noteworthy that nearly all religious systems have prescribed ablutions previous to the performance of religious duties, and the worship performed in the ancient Atlantean Mystery Temple, the Tabernacle in the Wilderness, was no exception, as we have seen from the previous articles on symbols of ancient and modern initiation. After having obtained justification by sacrifice on the brazen altar, the candidate was compelled to wash in the laver of consecration, the molten sea, before he was allowed to enter upon the duties of his ministry in the sanctuary proper. And it is in conformity with this rule that we find the hero of the Gospels going to the River Jordan, where he underwent the mystic rite of baptism. When he rose, we learn that the Spirit descended upon him. Therefore, it is obvious that those who follow the Christian mystic path of initiation must also be similarly baptized before they can receive the Spirit. which is to be their true guide through all the trials before them. But what constitutes baptism is a question which has called forth arguments of almost unbelievable intensity. Some contend that it is a sprinkling with water, and others insist upon the immersion of the whole body. Some say that it is sufficient to take an infant into church, sprinkle it with water despite its protests, and presto, it becomes a Christian, an heir of heaven. Whereas, should it unfortunately die before this sacred rite is performed, it must inevitably go to hell. Others take the more logical position that the desire of an individual for admission into the church is the prime factor necessary to make the rite effective, and therefore wait until adult age before the performance of the ceremony, which requires an immersion of the whole body in water. But whether the rite is performed in an infancy or in later life, it seems strange that momentary immersion or sprinkling with water should have the power to save the soul. And when we examine the subsequent life of those who have thus been baptized, even in adult age and with their full consent and desire, we find little or no improvement in the great majority. Therefore, it seems evident that this cannot be the proper rite, because the Spirit has not descended upon them. Consequently, we must look for another explanation of what constitutes a true mystic rite of baptism. A story is told of an Ottoman king who declared war on a neighboring nation, fought a number of battles against it with varying success, but was finally conquered and taken captive to the palace of the victor, where he was compelled to work in the most menial capacity as a slave. After many years, fortune favored him, and he escaped to a far country, where by hard work he acquired a small estate, married, and had a number of children who grew up around him. Finally, he found himself upon his deathbed at a very ripe old age, and in the exertion of drawing his last breath, he raised himself upon his pillow and looked about him, but there was no sons and daughters there. He was not in the place which he had regarded as home for so many years, but in his own palace, which he thought he had left in his youth. And he was as young as when he left it. There he found himself sitting in a chair with a basin of water close to his chin, and a servant engaged in washing his hair and beard. He had just immersed his face in the water when the dream of going to war had started, and a lifetime had been lived in a dreamland during the few seconds it took until he raised his face. There are thousands of other instances to show that outside the physical world, time is non-existent, and the happenings of millennia are easily inspected in a few moments. It is well known that when people are under water and in the act of drowning, their whole preceding life is reenacted before their eyes with a crystal clarity. Even the minutest details which have been forgotten during the passing years standing out sharply. Thus, there must be and is a storehouse of events which may be contacted under certain conditions when the senses are stilled and we are near sleep or death. To make this last sentence clear, it should be understood and borne in mind that man is a composite being having finer vehicles which interpenetrate the physical body, usually regarded as the whole man. During death and sleep, this dense body is unconscious on account of a complete separation between it and the finer vehicles. But this separation is only partial during dream-filled sleep prior to drowning. This condition enables the spirit to impress events upon the brain with more or less accuracy according to circumstances, particularly those incidents which are connected with itself. In the light of these things, we shall understand what really constitutes the rite of baptism. According to the nebular theory, that which is now the earth was at one time a luminous fire mist, which gradually cooled by contact with the cold of space. This meeting of heat with cold generated moisture, which evaporated and rose from the heated center until the cold condensed it, and it fell again as moisture upon the heated world. The surface of the earth being thus subjected to alternate liquidation and evaporation for ages, it finally crystallized into a shell which perfectly covered the fiery center. This soft, moisture-laden shell naturally generated a mist which surrounded the planet as an atmosphere, and this was the cradle of everything that has its being upon the earth, man, animal, and planet. The Bible describes this condition in the second chapter of Genesis, where we are told that the time of the first man, a mist went up from the earth, for it had not yet rained. This condition evidently continued until the flood, when the moisture finally descended and left the atmosphere clear so that the rainbow was seen for the first time. The darkness was dispelled, and the age of alternation, day and night, summer and winter, commenced. By a study of cosmology and the pictorial account of evolution given in the Northern Eddas, treasured among the sages of Scandinavian before the Christian era, we may learn more of this period in the Earth's history and the bearing which it has upon our subject. As we teach our children, by means of stories and pictures, truths that they could not intellectually grasp, so the divine leaders of mankind were wanting to teach the infant souls in their charge by pictures and allegories, and through these prepare them for a higher and nobler teaching of a later day. The great epic poem, which is called The Lay of Nibelung, gives us the story of which we are in search, the cosmic origin of the rite of baptism, and why it is necessarily the preliminary step in the spiritual unfoldment of the Christian mystic. The cosmogony of the Eddas is similar to that of the Bible in some respects, and in others gives points which bear out the theory of Laplace. We quote from the poetical version of Oehlenschläger: in the being's earliest dawn, all was one dark abyss. Nor heaven nor earth was known, chill noxious fogs and ice. North from the murk, Niflheim's hole, piled up in mountains lay from Muspel's radiant pole, southwards fire held the sway. Then after ages past, mid in the chaos met a warm breath, Niflheim's blast, cold with prolific heat. Hence pregnant drops were formed, which by the parent air from Muspel's region warmed, produced great Argelmer. Thus, by the action of heat and cold, Argelmer, or as he is called, the giant, was first formed. This was the pregnant seed, ground whence came the spiritual hierarchies, the spirits of earth, air, and water, and finally man. At the same time, the All-Father created the cow, Adumla, from whose four breasts issued forth streams of milk, which nourished all beings. These are the four ethers, one of which now sustains mineral, two feed the plant, three the animal, and all four the human kingdom. In the Bible, they are the four rivers which went forth out of Eden. Eventually, as postulated by science, a crust must have been formed by the continued boiling of the water, and from this dying crust the mist must have ascended, as taught in the second chapter of Genesis. By degrees, the mist must have cooled and condensed, shutting out the light of the sun, so that it would have been impossible for early mankind to perceive the body, even had they possessed the physical vision. But under such conditions, they had no more need of eyes than a mole which burrows in the ground. They were not blind, however, for we are told that they saw God. And as spiritual things and beings are spiritually perceived, they must have been gifted with spiritual sight. In the spiritual worlds, there is a different standard of reality than here, which is the basis of myths. Under these conditions, there could be no clashing of interests, and humanity regarded itself as the children of one great father while they lived under the water of ancient Atlantis. Egoism did not come into the world until the mist had condensed and they had left the watery atmosphere of Atlantis, when their eyes had been opened so that they could perceive the physical world and the things therein, when each saw himself or herself as separate and apart from all others, the consciousness of me and mine, thee and thine, took shape in the nascent minds, and a grasping greed replaced the fellow feeling which obtained under the waters of early Atlantis. From that time to the present stage of egoism has been considered the legitimate attitude, and even in our boasted civilization, altruism remains a utopian dream not to be indulged in by practical people. Had mankind been allowed to travel the path of egoism without let or hindrance, it is difficult to see where it would all have ended. But under the immutable law of consequence, every cause must produce an adequate effect. The principle of suffering was born from sin for the benevolent purpose of guiding us back to the path of virtue. It takes much suffering and many lives to accomplish this purpose. But finally, when we have become men of sorrows and acquainted with grief, when we have cultivated that keen and ready sympathy which feels all the woe of the world, when the Christ has been born within, there comes to the Christian mystic that ardent aspiration to seek and to save those who are lost and show them the way to everlasting light and peace. But to show the way, we must know the way. Without a true understanding of the cause of sorrow, we cannot teach others to obtain permanent peace. Nor can this understanding of sorrow and sin and death be obtained from books, lectures, or even the personal teachings of another. At least, an impression sufficiently intense to fill the aspirant's whole being cannot be conveyed in that way. Baptism alone will accomplish the purpose in an adequate manner. Therefore, the first step in the life of a Christian mystic is baptism. But when we say baptism, we do not necessarily mean a physical baptism where the candidate is either sprinkled or immersed, and where he makes a certain promise to the one who baptizes him. The mystic baptism may take place in a desert, as easily on an island, for it is a spiritual process to attain a spiritual purpose. It may take place at any time during the night or day, in summer or winter, for it occurs at the moment when the candidate feels with sufficient intensity the longing to know the cause of sorrow and alleviate it. Then the spirit is conducted under the waters of Atlantis, where it sees the primal condition of brotherly love and kindness, where it perceives God as the great father of his children, who are there surrounded by his wonderful love. And by the conscious return of this ocean of love, the candidate becomes so thoroughly imbued with the feelings of that kinship that the spirit of egoism is banished from him forever. It is because of this saturation with the universal spirit that is able later to say, quote, "If a man takes your coat, give him your cloak also. If he asks you to walk 1 mile with him, go with him 2 miles," end quote. Feeling himself one and all, the candidate does not even consider the murder of himself as a mistreatment, but can say, "Father, forgive them." They are identical with himself, who suffers by their action. He is the aggressor as well as the victim. Such is true, the spiritual baptism of the Christian mystic. And any other baptism that does not produce this universal fellow feeling is not worthy of the name. Certainly some continued allusion, probably more so than in the rest of the book. Now with this idea of baptism, we go into almost this more universal cosmic type baptism idea. And actually comes full circle to this kind of idea of intent. What is your intent in walking the path? You know, if it's not pure, then it doesn't matter. And so early on in this particular chapter, it does talk about the kind of going through the motions, if you will, of the path of the Christian mystic. And if you aren't truly ready, then it doesn't really matter. I find this an interesting idea because when we think about intent, why you start doing anything, are you just going through the motions of your family? Do you really feel like an aspirant in this respect? And then something else that stuck out to me in terms of this particular chapter was the continued reference to this allegory of Atlantis, perhaps home to some superior type of a society. And I find this very interesting as well, because as a scholar of history, I look at things like the story of Atlantis, and I don't necessarily believe that it was a real place. Now, I know some of you are going, "What? How could you say that?" And I say that because it's just what I've read and been able to parallel read and look at the different sources and the translations. I'm not entirely sure it says what we say it says. So take that and tuck it in the back of your brain, maybe. My question for the Craftsman Plus this week is this: have you been baptized in your tradition, or is there something that kind of equates to the same thing as baptism in your religion or your personal spiritual philosophy? And if so, in that you've gone through it, how did that affect you? Did it feel as if you are truly set on a path now, or was it more of a motions kind of thing? I look forward to reading your responses later in the week. Now for our second piece this week, I'd like to take us on a little bit of a journey as we open up the discussion with the legend of the Emerald Tablets. Now a few months ago, the Masonic Philosophical Society published an article called The Legend of the Emerald Tablets. And I'd like to read that and then go into a discussion about the common archetype of some sort of device that is used to convey knowledge in a way that allows it to be preserved. Here we go. The Legend of the Emerald Tablets, November 2nd, 2020, Masonic Philosophical Society, writer Joe. Sic mundus, creatus est. Thus the world was created. In the modern world, technology advances from year to year. The arrow of progress drives ever forward. The past is a place of ignorance and squalor, a place without electricity, without light, but some profess a secret knowledge, hailing from a time when man knew the mysteries of the universe and the hidden power of alchemy. If any readers have witnessed the recent series on Netflix, Dark, they will have come across this ancient marvel. For upon the back of the mysterious priest is written the words of the Emerald Tablet, also known as the Smaragdan Tablet. It is an old tale passed down into legend, into myth, and finally into fiction. But as with all old stories, some hold there is a grain of truth hidden under the whispers of the years. The story tells of a godman, Hermes Trismegistus, in the land of Hellenic Egypt. Here was a hybrid place, for the 4,000-year-old Egyptian culture headed by the Greek Alexander the Great. Here the gods blended with the Greek Hermes, herald of the gods, and the Egyptian Thoth, the god of wisdom, blurring into one, the thrice great, Hermes, Trismegistus, Thoth, and Mercury, together. It is said Trismegistus was the first to write the Hermetica, a book of powerful knowledge that was destined to become the basis of Western alchemy. From this ancient book, a piece was taken, written cryptically in the old Phoenician alphabet, the language of Carthage and Canaan, from which our own alphabet is devised. Into these carved words, Hermes Trismegistus inscribed the secrets of the universe. It describes the prima materia, the first matter of creation, out of which all else was born. Such material was essential in alchemy and was of the utmost importance for those who sought to create the philosopher's stone. The tablets were inevitably lost until, as legend has it, they were rediscovered in a caved tomb in Tyana, in the cold, dead hands of Hermes himself, sat upon a golden throne. In truth, the tablets were likely a fiction, the origins for a copied text invented by a later author. The work now known as the Emerald Tablets first appeared in the West in the book Secretum Secretorum, but it was derived from a much older text. The Kitab Sur al-Asar was written in the 8th century and attributed to Jabir ibn Hayyan. Called the father of chemistry, Jabir's writings contain the oldest known systematic classification of chemical substances, as well as the first written record of the Emerald Tablet. Quote, "Truth, certainty, that, in which there is no doubt, that which is above from that which is below, and that which is below is from that which is above, working the miracles of one." Jabir ibn Hayyan. However, the Hermetica itself does date to Ptolemaic Egypt. The text likely began in Arabic, traveling steadily into Europe. It was then translated into Latin in the 12th century. From there, the secret knowledge trickled through the alchemy community, becoming a highly influential text. It was Isaac Newton, famed for his gravitational discoveries, but who had a penchant for the supernatural, who translated the text into English. The words are poetic and otherworldly. Newton speaks of a strange substance and process. Whatever the truth, the origins of the Emerald Tablet remain hidden. And perhaps that's what captures us most of all, an ancient mystery of unknown genesis awaiting our discovery. Quote, "Separate thou the earth from the fire, the subtle from the gross. Sweetly, with great industry, it ascends from earth to heaven, and again it descends to the earth." End quote. Sir Isaac Newton. There you have this review of the Emerald Tablet, and some basic history on it and where it possibly came from. It is, like many things, a figment that was made up and added at a later date by people who are looking to enhance an older text. A common practice in the day was to find something that is in vogue and then to embellish upon it when there is not enough knowledge known about it yet, so somebody can become a very quick expert on the topic
and surely insert something into the text and then become the charlatan, if you will. But what I want to talk about in this instance is that we have something in Freemasonry that is very similar, this kind of thing where all of the occult sciences and the knowledge of the world is contained on the Emerald Tablets. Well, this is also true with the Masonic pillars, right, where we talk about them quite often as this thing that is the repository of the archives of Masonry, which were cast, right, the pillars, to survive conflagration and inundation. Now, conflagration means fire, inundation means water. But then you're left asking yourself, well, we really don't hear much else about these pillars in Masonic circles or groups or in ritual even. So what's the truth here? And what I can tell you is that there is, in fact, somewhat of a mix-up, and we're going to get into that in just a moment when we read this next piece. But before we do that, let's take a look at some of the history behind the two pillars, Boaz and Jachin. So according to the Bible, Boaz and Jachin were two copper, brass, or bronze pillars which stand on the porch of Solomon's temple in the first temple in Jerusalem. They're sometimes used as symbols within our fraternity and Freemasonry, but it's also used in tarot. It's noted that they're probably not support structures, but are freestanding based on similar pillars found in other nearby temples. So in the Bible, the pillars had a size that about 6 feet thick and 27 feet tall. And then the chapiters are 8 feet and cast in brass. On top of the columns, they had decorations in further brass carving or etching or denting, right? Like embossing of lilies. And then the original measurement as taken from the Torah is in cubits, which records that the pillars were 18 cubits high, 12 cubits around, and hollow, 4 fingers thick. That comes from Jeremiah 52:21-22. Nets of checkerwork covered the bowl of each of the chapiters, decorated with rows of 200 pomegranates, wreathed with 7 chains for each chapiter, and topped with lilies. That's 1 Kings 7:13-22, 41-42. And the pillars did not survive destruction of the first temple, and because in Jeremiah 52:17 it says that the Chaldeans broke up the bronze columns of the house of the Lord. And then in Kings 25:13 it says, it has something similar. It says the pillars were carried away in pieces for ease of transportation when the second temple was built. They were not returned, and there exists no record of new pillars being constructed to replace them. We have to ask, what real source do we have to say that these even existed outside of the Bible? Well, Josephus, the historian, also has mention of them. He says, Boaz, strength, stood on the left on the portico of Solomon's temple, while Jachin, he will establish, or it will establish, stood on the right, and the two were made by an Israelite craftsman named Hiram. Crazy, it's in Josephus. So there you have some additional context on these two pillars, and now I want to read you a short talk bulletin from 1935, number 9, by Unknown, and it's called Two Pillars. Few references in Freemasonry are less understood than the two brazen pillars in the porch of King Solomon's temple. Probably a greater mass of misinformation exists regarding these than any other symbol in the craft. Early ritualists confused the mythical pillars of stone spoken of in almost all old charges or manuscript constitutions of the craft with the brazen pillars of the porch. The result is that modern Freemasons have composite pillars, fusing of the ancient and the mythological pillars on which were supposed to be engraved the arts and sciences of the time before the flood, and those which Hiram erected, undoubtedly with Egyptian influences and memories of Egyptian temples to guide him before the great house of the Lord which Solomon built. The fascinating, if wholly legendary, history of the craft, repeated with variations in the majority of the old manuscript rolls, beginning with the Regis of 1390, is older than any Freemasonry we know in practice. The story varies from manuscript to manuscript, but in its essentials, it is much the same. It was evidently a tradition as strong in its day as is our legend of Hiram, To quote but a few lines bearing on the pillars, consider these words from the York Manuscript No. 1, written about A.D. or C.E. 1600. Quote, "Before Noah's flood, there was a man called Lamech, as is written in the scriptures in Yea Charter of Genesis. And this Lamech had two wives, yea, one named Ada, by whom he had two sons, yea, one named Jabal, yea, other named Jubal. And his other wife was called Zilah, by whom he had one son named Tubal-Cain, and one daughter named Naamah. And these four children founded yea beings of all yea sciences in yea world. Jabal, yea oldest son, found out yea science of geometry. He was a keeper of flocks and sheep, lands in the fields, as it is noted in yea chapter before. And his brother Jubal found yea science of music song of the tongue, harp, and organ. And yea, third brother Tubal-Cain found yea science of smithcraft, of gold, silver, iron, copper, and steel. And yea daughter found yea era of weaving. And these persons, knowing right well that God would take vengeance for sin, either by fire or water, where forever they writ their several sciences that they had found in two pillars of stone that might be found after Noah's flood. And yea, one stone would not burn with fire, and the other called laterns, because it would not drown with water." End quote. The word here spelled laterns, L-T-E-R-N-E-S, is rendered on the old constitutions as laterns, usually translated to brick. But marble does not resist fire. Brick, especially early unscientifically vitrified brick, does not resist water. If the word be considered a perversion of Latin, which means brass or bronze, then the ancient legendary pillars are made of metal and marble, a more sensible idea, since metal would resist fire and the marble water. In Tyre was the great temple to Heracles, with two pillars, one of gold, the other of smaragdus, which is polished green marble. Other Tyrian temples, to Melkarth, had two metal pillars, or two monoliths. Modern masonry has hollow pillars to serve as safe repositories for the quote-unquote archives of masonry, and to preserve them from flood and fire, in spite of the fact that sacred history says nothing of masonry or the reason for the pillars being hollow. It is reasonable to suppose that the ancient Masonic tradition of Lamech's children and their pillars was confused, as knowledge of the Bible became more common after the invention of printing, with the other brazen pillars of the ancient day, and finally with those of Solomon's temple. How high were the pillars? A question which has agitated American Freemasonry, largely without reason, for many years. A majority of American rituals state that they were 35 cubits in height. A minority hold to 18. One compromises on 30. A few do not give the height at all. Mackey's Revised Encyclopedia of Freemasonry says, quote, "Immediately within the porch of the temple and on each side of the door were placed two hollow brazen pillars. The height of each was 27 feet, and the diameter about 6 feet, and the thickness of the brass 3 inches. Above the pillar and covering its upper part to the depth of 9 inches was an oval body or chapiter, 7 feet and a half in height. Springing out from the pillar at the junction of the chapiter with it was a row of lotus petals, which first spreading around the chapiter, afterwards gently curved downward toward the pillar, something like the acanthus leaves on the capital of a Corinthian column. About 2/5 of the distance from the bottom of the chapiter, or just below its most bulging part, a tissue of network was carved, which extended over its whole upper surface. To the bottom of this network was suspended a series of fringes, and on these again were carved two rows of pomegranates, 100 being in each row." End quote. This description, it seemed to Dr. Mackey, is the only one that can be reconciled with the various passages which relate to these pillars in the Book of Kings, Chronicles, and Josephus, to give a correct conception of the architecture of these symbols. In 1904, Brother John W. Berry of Iowa, later to become Grand Master, rendered an exhaustive report to his Grand Lodge on the height of the pillars, proving anew the belief, practically accepted by biblical students, that the 35 dimension is that of both pillars together, the actual height of each being 18 cubits. The confusion arises in the two accounts in Chronicles and Kings. Various explanations have been advanced as to the discrepancy between 35 as a height of each. The missing cubit is explained on the theory that, while actually each pillar from root to summit was 18 cubits, only 17 and one half showed, the rest being hidden in chapiter and base. This explanation apparently began with the Genevan Bible, or the Breeches Bible, in which is a marginal note stating of the pillars every one was 18 cubits long, but half cubit could not be seen, for it was hid in the rounded of the chapiter, and therefore he giveth to every one 17.5. End quote. To know the quote-unquote actual size of the pillars, it is necessary to know the length of a cubit, and here is room for speculation in many authorities. The Abingdon Bible Commentary states, quote, "The common cubit equal to 18 inches, the longer royal cubit 20.5 inches, end quote. John Wesley Kelcher, whose restorations of King Solomon's Temple are to be found in Masonic Bibles, considers the cubit to be equal to 2 feet. The Standard Dictionary gives the cubit as the measure of length determined by the average arm from elbow to middle fingertip. The Britannica considers the temple cubit must have been in excess of 25 inches. Canon J.W. Horsley, past Grand Chaplain, England, who has studied and written much upon the pillars, give a table of sizes in which the cubit is but 14.25 inches. Many ritualists set forth the fact that Hiram cast the pillars on the plains of the Jordan in the clay ground between Succoth and Zarathan or Zarathatha. Both 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles are authority for the statement. But if there ever existed a clay ground in location specified, it has disappeared and left no trace. Explorations, Lynch in 1847, Ridgway in 1874, not only found no clay ground, but no trace of smelters, furnaces, or other means of melting and casting brass. The point is of little importance. The pillars and the temple vessels were cast somewhere, but a failure of fact in a statement so absolute may be an indication the other 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles statements about the pillars were also inaccurate as to facts. Vide, the height statements. The globes, celestial and terrestrial, which usually surmount American lodge room pillars, are wholly modern inventions without basis in scriptural fact. Somewhere, at some time, some ritual maker confused the spherical form of the chapter with an additional sphere. Desiring to account for it, he drew a map of the world on one and a map of the heavens on the other, but in the Kings and Chronicle accounts of Josephus, there are no mentions of celestial and terrestrial globes. All this is more interesting than important. The symbolical meaning of the pillars is the vital matter to Freemasons. In the eyes of critical scholarship, the ancient meaning was of the might and majesty of deity. From the dawn of religion, the pillar, monolith, or built up, has played an important part of the worship of the unseen. From the huge boulders of Stonehenge among which the Druids are supposed to have performed their rites, through East Indian temples to the religion of ancient Egypt, scholars trace the use of pillars as an essential part of the religious worship. Indeed, in Egypt, the obelisk stood for the very presence of the sun god himself. The ancient believed the earth to be flat, and that it was supported by 2 pillars of God placed at the western entrance of the world as then known. These are now called Gibraltar on one side of the strait and Quetta on the other. Some writers have suggested that the pillars represent the masculine and feminine elements in nature, others that they stand for authority of church and state, because on stated occasions the high priest stood before one pillar and the king before the other. Some students think that they allude to the 2 legendary pillars of Enoch, upon which tradition informs us all the wisdom of the ancient world was inscribed in order to preserve it from the inundation and conflagration. William Preston supposed that by them Solomon had reference to the pillars of cloud and fire which guided the children of Israel out of the bondage and into the promised land. One authority says a literal translation of their name is, "In thee is strength, and it shall be established," and by a natural transposition must then be expressed, "O Lord, thou art mighty, and thy power is established from everlasting to everlasting." Quoting Abingdon again, the fact that each pillar had a particular name further suggests that they were not simply a part of the architectural adornment, but originally bore some analogy to the pillars, which singly or in pairs formed an important feature of the Semitic sanctuary. At Melkart's shrine at Tyre, there were, according to Herodotus, 2 costly obelisks at which Melkart, and probably his wife consort, was worshipped. 2 pillars also stood before the temples in Paphos and in Hierapolis. Ashurbanipal, on the occasion of his expedition into Egypt and Ethiopia, recounts that part of his spoil included 2 obelisks, high with resplendent plating of fine workmanship, from the threshold of the gate of the temple. Therefore, these pillars at Jerusalem, built like the temple itself by Phoenician workmen, were probably intended to be symbols of the deity. They were an artist refinement of Mezabah, or stone obelisk, which at many Israelite sanctuaries still stood beside the altar in much later days. But it does not necessarily follow that Solomon and his subjects so interpreted the significance of these novel and foreign brass objects. For them, the ark in the oracle seemed to have symbolized Jehovah. But it is possible that instead of Jachin, or Jachin, he, Jehovah, was carved on one pillar by Huram Abi, and subsequently altered into his name, and Boaz, in him his strength, may be later a substitution for Tammuz, whose cult was very prevalent in the Semitic world. The entered apprentice, in the process of being passed to the degree of fellowcraft, passes between the pillars. No hint is given that he should pass nearer to one than the other. No suggestion is made that he either may work a greater influence than the other. He merely passes between them. A deep significance is in this very omission. Masons refer to the promise of God unto David. The interested may read chapter 7 of 2 Samuel and gather that the establishment promised by the Lord was that of a house, a family, a descent of blood from David unto his children and his children's children. Used to blast stumps from the field, dynamite is an aid to the farmer. Used in war, it kills and maims. Fire cooks food and makes steam for engines. Fire also burns houses and destroys forests. But it is not the power, but the use of power, which is good or bad. The truth applies to any power, spiritual, legal, monarchical, political, or personal. Power is without either virtue or vice. The user may use it well or ill, as he pleases. Freemasonry passes the brother in the process of becoming a fellowcraft between the pillar of strength, power, and the pillar of establishment, choice, or control. He is a man now and no minor or infant. He has grown up Masonically. Before him are spread the two great essentials to all success, all greatness, and all happiness. Like any other power, temporal or physical, religious or spiritual, Freemasonry can be used well or ill. Here is the lesson set before the fellowcraft. If he, like David, would have his kingdom of Masonic manhood established in strength, he must pass between the pillars with understanding that power without control is useless, and control without power is futile. Each is a complement of the other. In the passage between the pillars, the fellowcraft not only has his feet set upon the winding stairs, but is given so he has eyes to see and ears to hear, secret instructions as to how he shall climb those stairs, that he may indeed reach the middle chamber. He is to climb by strength, but directed by wisdom. He is to progress by power, but guide by control. He must rise by the might that is in him, but arrive by wisdom of his heart. So consider the inaccuracies and misstatements of ritual regarding the pillars became relatively unimportant, whether 18 or 35 cubits in height, whether cast in one place or another, whether or not surmounted in Solomon's day with globes, terrestrial and celestial, matter little. The lesson is there, the meaning of the symbol to be read. The initiate of old saw in the obelisk the very spirit of God that he worshipped. The modern Masonic initiate may see in the two pillars the means by which he may travel a little further, a little higher, toward the secret middle chamber of life, in which dwells the unseen presence. So there you have this awesome piece that actually I have read for you in the past, but I wanted to read it again because it's been a long time and I love the topic so much. In fact, I think there's a grouping of podcasts in a row that I frequently was talking about this idea. So here we have a couple more, right? We have this idea of the Emerald Tablet, and then we talk about the same two pillars in Enoch, the pillars of Enoch, and then we talk about the ones referenced by the children of Lamech, and somehow the Masonic pillars have taken all of those traditions and mushed them together to form what we have here in modern day Masonry, to represent a way to think about Masonry as a repository of knowledge, but also venerating the symbolism that such architectural marvels like pillars affect the human. My question for the Craftsman Plus is just kind of open-ended. I'd really like to know what you think about this idea of an archive of information. Is it possible that in a time before recorded history, maybe something like Antediluvian or Atlantean? Ooh, didn't I say I didn't believe in that? That doesn't mean I don't believe in a time before a great flood. Was there a time that civilizations had a knowledge that they attempted to preserve, and that these similar stories are mythologies based on a common happening. Not unlike the flood, global flood myths, right? So think about that. I hope this sets your mind on fire and you're really curious. And I will try to find some information and look more into the Pillars of Enoch in an upcoming episode. So look forward to that. And of course, look forward to the interview with John Ruhr coming just around the corner. Until next week, I want to wish you all adieu. Thank you very much for joining me on this episode. I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors once more, and especially our legacy partners. Without all of you, we cannot make this program. You guys make it happen, and it is just an honor to be able to do this for you all week after week. So thank you for letting me be the person to bring this Masonic education to you. That's it. So we'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.